say why. Why the perfect murder?
Oh, aye. It can't be detected. That's what he said. It leaves no trace at all, just dissolves into the blood.
And what did your son say to you, Mrs. Marshall?
He said, I know Alice has tried to poison me.
He opened the door and found himself in the hands of two murderous brutes. Then he was dragged back into the parlor and this time murdered.
Murder Most Foul. Six forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 4, The Bloodstained Handkerchief.
At about 5:45 on the evening of the 7th of February 1968, a young woman was dropped off by an office mate at her flat in Deepdene Court on the outskirts of London. Her name was Claire Josephs. She'd acquired her surname 5 months earlier when she'd married, and indeed at 6 o'clock that night, her mother-in-law phoned her.
Bernard? He's at an office party. He told you. Yes, I'm making a lemon souffle. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'll look it up. No, I'll make him something when he gets back. Yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow. Right, bye now.
It was soon after 8 o'clock that Claire's husband, Bernard, arrived home to find the flat in darkness.
Claire, I'm back. Claire? Where are you? In the bedroom. Claire? Claire? Oh, my God. Oh, God.
What do you say, Doc?
I've never seen a wound like this in my life.
Yeah.
As you can see, her head's almost severed from her body. It's been both slashed and stabbed. He used a long knife, one with a serrated edge. Maybe a bread knife.
Simmons, see if there's a bread knife in the kitchen.
Will do, Gov.
Have you found anything of help yet?
Not yet. Her husband seems genuine. He phoned his family and his wife's family after he'd found the body. Then he phoned for an ambulance and his doctor. I don't think he knew what he was doing, and I'm not surprised. They all got here, then he thought to ring us. So if the murderer left his card, it's likely to have been lost in the scrummage.
It looks as if he tried to rip her dress open, but there was no sexual assault.
My husband says he got back at 8, so how long do you think?
She's not yet cold. 2 hours at the most.
That adds up. She was on the phone at 6, around 7.
I've done all I can do here. Can I take her away?
Yeah, okay.
See you in the mortuary.
They bread knife isn't in its slot, sir.
Okay, search for it, but I doubt if we'll find it.
Peck has found something, sir.
What have you found, Peck?
This. A blood-stained handkerchief. Man's size.
Found where?
In the hall. Under the mat by the front door. Maybe it got lost under there in all the commotion.
Well done, Peck. Let Dr. Pereira have it.
He must have quite a bit of blood on him.
There was also 2 coffee cups on the table, sir.
So she gave him coffee. Stopped her cooking. She must have known him. Must have. Dr. Pereira will want them.
Yes, sir.
He took nothing except the knife and left his handkerchief.
Bernard Josephs was at an office party, was he?
Yes. She knew he'd be home about 8.
But did our murderer?
Could be. So as not to be seen leaving, he turns the lights off. He thought of that. Did he come by car?
cars in the locality between 6 and 7.30.
We've got someone onto that, sir. No, that's the forensic crowd.
See that they get their handkerchief, yes? And listen, let's keep the theory that he was invited in to ourselves. I'll ask the two families to do the same. It'll cause complications with the media and the press, but it will give us time to check through the Joseph's friends and give Dr. Pereira time. So for the moment, it'll have to be our old friend, the unknown homicidal maniac.
Superintendent Bob Cumming was one of Kent's most experienced detectives. He appointed Bill Peck, the sergeant who'd found the handkerchief, as his right-hand man, with D.C. Reg Simmons bringing up the rear. A large, but ultimately unsuccessful, search was made for the bread knife. It had been a wedding present to the Josephs. There were reports that a white sports car had been parked in the vicinity of Deep Dean Court, where the murder had taken place. Owners of such cars in West Wickham and the surrounding area were asked to come forward so that they could be eliminated from the inquiry. And the idea of an unknown homicidal maniac caused quite a stir in the community.
There was a man up there on their balcony, bending down so as not to be seen, at about 7.30.
In the dark, madam?
Well, there was a light on behind him. He was quite clear. There's a dirty-looking man who does his rounds on a Wednesday, the day she was killed. He says he's a woodcutter.
My flat in Bromley when I was out the other evening, 2 days after the murder. But my wife refused to open the door to him. We are only a stone's throw from West Wickham.
The police are keeping a watch at the crime prevention exhibition at Bromley High Street in case they might hear something which could lead them to the murderer.
I asked the bus crews on the local 126 route if they'd had a passenger with blood on his clothes in the night in question. Reaction was, pull the other one, mate, sir.
The murder of Claire Josephs appears to have been the work of a homicidal maniac, whom the police believe may strike again at any time.
We had an officer crouched down on the balcony at 7.30 with a light on behind him, and he was invisible.
There were also the usual half a dozen men in various states of imaginative delirium who gave themselves up as the murderer. The woodcutter was harmless. The man who called on the wife at Bromley called no more. And no incriminating conversations were overheard at the crime prevention exhibition. While all this went on, Dr. Margaret Pereira, the principal scientific officer at the Metz laboratory, was at work cutting up the blood-stained handkerchief and submitting the resulting squares to saline solution plus some chemicals in a test pioneered by her colleagues. A few years earlier, Dr. Pereira had found a way of isolating a wide range of blood groups from stains of blood no larger than a twopenny piece.
We know the dead woman's blood group, Mr. Cumming.
Can it help us?
I think so. It's a very unusual variant of the AB group. We call it AB-NN/PGM21. Very rare. Probably only 100 people in the country have it.
And it's on the handkerchief, I take it?
It is. And there's another blood type on it. It's a pretty rare O blood group. Could be the murderer's.
It's certainly a man's handkerchief, and not one of Mr. Joseph's.
If there's a trace of Claire Joseph's blood on anything belonging to a suspect, we'll get...
At Deep Dean Court, Sergeant Peck and D.C. Simmons were going through Claire's papers. There were cards to her, invitations, her diary. They sent the names of any men they came across to the Yard's Criminal Records Office, on the off chance that one of them might have got a record. It was a possibility, it must be said. They thought, unlikely.
Here's a photo. Too blurred to identify anyone.
Oh, better file it anyway.
Hairbrush.
Lipstick. Boyle, sweet. Justice got to go through, Sergeant.
I hate this sort of job. It's ghoulish.
I find it bloody sad. This was your life, Claire Joseph.
And how? D.S. Peck here. Yes, that's the name. Yes? Go ahead. You don't say. Will you let the super have the details? Thank you.
Have you got a name?
Roger John Payne. Two convictions for assaulting women. How did we come across him?
Well, this is the stuff we've been through. Being here. Somewhere. Payne. Roger John Payne. Here we are. It's a wedding invitation.
Yeah, I remember this. On the 20th of October, 1966, Mary to Roger John Payne.
They live near Maidstone, place called Harrietsham. So there we must go, Peck.
Okay. How do we play?
Softly, softly. Let's hope his wife's alone.
What's his record, sir?
When he was 17, he entered a girl's room with a knife and tried to rape her. Got 3 years on probation. In 65, he got 3 months for assaulting a middle-aged woman. No knife mentioned.
I wonder if he drives a white Triumph sports job.
If he did it, he'd have blood on him, and it'd be on the car, and Dr. Pereira would have a field day.
If he did it, he took the bread knife with him.
Yes. I wonder if he has an alibi. So we're having a word with all those friends of Claire Joseph's we can trace, Mrs. Payne.
Oh, I see. How did you know? I mean, you know, find out
that
we...
The invitation to your wedding was among her papers.
When did you last see her, Mrs. Payne?
Well, we often spoke on the phone. When did I see her last? Let me think. Last month, just after the new year, I went over to see the flat. I hadn't seen it before.
You went alone, I take it?
Yes. Straight from the office. But Roger came on later to pick me up.
How long had you known Claire?
About 4 years. Claire started work at the firm I was then with, and we became friends.
And you kept in contact, of course?
Well, I was very, very fond of her. And she had so much life in her. Her father phoned me on the night of her death. It was shattering, terrible. And when Roger got back, he found me in floods of tears.
Did Claire tell you that her husband was at an office party that evening, by any chance?
I don't know. Why'd you ask?
Well, only because we're trying to trace anyone who did know, who then might have mentioned it, and the murderer overheard, and that sort of thing.
Oh, I see. Let me think.
Because, you see, we think the murderer knew her, and knew she'd be alone for an hour or so that evening.
We spoke on the phone the day before. She might have said...
We've been told she was quite a chatterbox.
Yes, I suppose she was. She liked to tell you what she was up to and ask about your plans. It wasn't just some stranger. Do you have any idea?
Well, it's early days, Mrs. Payne, early days. Your husband must have been upset at the news.
Roger, yes.
What time did he get back?
I can't remember. He arrived home late. He's wet through. His car had packed up on the way. He found me in tears. He was very upset. That must be him now. Bruce knows the sound of his car. Will you just excuse me? Quiet, Bruce. Quiet now.
What do you reckon, Gov?
She's not holding anything back, but she's worried.
She must know his record.
If she met him after his last time inside, why should she?
She knows it. That's why.
How do you do, Mr. Payne?
Hello.
I'm Detective Superintendent Cumming, and this is Detective Sergeant Peck.
How do you do?
My wife told me why you're here.
Oh, routine stuff, as we said.
Seeing all Claire's friends and acquaintances.
I guessed you'd have to.
You look as if you've been in the wars, Mr. Payne.
The wars? Why?
Well, you've got a nasty cut on the forehead and your hands.
Roger did that when the car bonnet came down on him. When the car broke down on that night, I told you.
Yes, of course you did, Mrs. Payne. Mr. Payne, can you tell us where you were on that night, the night of the 7th?
I'm not answering any questions without my lawyer present.
And that, for the moment, was that, though for obvious reasons, Payne was now the detective's prime suspect. Meanwhile, at the Met's laboratory, Dr. Pereira had found a good deal more evidence which the murderer had left behind, and she'd taken the blood-stained handkerchief to pieces thread by thread. She'd found some dog's hairs entwined in the fibres. It was time to bring Payne in to Bromley Police Station for questioning, this time with his lawyer.
It's on the record, Mr. Payne, that you've had two convictions for assaulting women, one with a knife. This looks bad for you, doesn't it?
My client didn't have to answer that.
I've had treatment since the last time.
You didn't rape either woman. Why not? Wasn't that your intention?
You don't have to answer that, Roger.
I will, though. The truth is, I'm impotent. That's the trouble.
So you want to rape them, but you can't, so you assault them instead. And with Claire Josephs, you went much too far.
My client has no comment, Mr. Cumming, to that accusation.
What about your movements on the day of the murder, the 7th?
I thought my wife would have told you most of that.
No, she didn't. We didn't ask her. Will you tell me?
You can answer that, Roger.
My wife didn't know where I was that evening. At 7, anyway.
Don't volunteer statements. Just answer the questions.
So where were you on the 7th?
All over the place. But I was at my mother's in Carshalton at about 7 that evening.
His mother, Mrs. Irene Payne, will confirm that.
Twice Payne had mentioned 7 o'clock that evening. Why did that preoccupy him? It just so happened that 7 o'clock was about the time of the murder. The detectives had no solid evidence to go on. Nonetheless, they decided to take the risk of holding Payne in custody. That would allow forensic samples to be collected from him and from his clothes and car, and his blood group could be ascertained. Margaret Pereira and her team would have to work fast. She did just that, and with such emphatic results that Roger Payne was charged with murder. The Old Bailey on the 15th of May 1968, with the prosecuting counsel, John Buzzard, QC.
So this man, the husband of a good friend, was invited in and given coffee and biscuits by the petite 20-year-old wife of Bernard Josephs, a wife he had married but 5 months earlier. With his coffee but half drunk, Payne must have suddenly and savagely attacked her and tried to strangle her. She broke free, fled into the bedroom, but before she could lock herself in, Payne went for her again, this time with the long bread knife he'd taken from the kitchen. With it, he stabbed and slashed at her throat with such force, he all but severed her head from her body. As he left the scene of his dastardly crime, he switched the flat's lights off. But he left one vital clue behind, which the Crown will divulge later in the case.
Roger Payne's defence counsel, Gordon Graham, put his client on the witness stand to tell his own story of that day.
I left home at 11:30 in the morning and drove to Fleet Street for an interview regarding a job at a bank there. I had some lunch in Fleet Street, then I drove to Sutton to see some friends, Mr. and Mrs. Goulding, but they weren't in. So about 4:30 I decided to drive over to see my mother at Carshalton, but my car broke down, and after repairing the fault, I didn't get to my mother's until about 6:45 or 7 o'clock. I left my mother at about 7:40, but didn't get home until 10 to 10 as the car broke down again.
What happened during the second breakdown, Mr. Payne?
While I was repairing it, the bonnet fell on my head and cut it.
I suppose your suit suffered during these repairs. And it was raining, was it not?
Yes, very hard. My suit was dirty, so I took it to the cleaners the next morning.
Once the accused had decided to give evidence in his own defence, Mr. Buzzard had the right to cross-examine.
You had quite an adventurous day on the day of the murder, Mr. Payne. What was wrong with your car to cause it to break down twice?
The first time it was the spark plugs. They were damp and rather dirty. The second time it was the ignition, an electrical fault.
I see. Now, the couple you drove to see in Sutton, were they old friends?
I've known them for 5 or 6 years.
And they are about the same age as yourself?
Yes, about the same.
I take it that they have jobs, that they leave home to go to work?
He does, yes. I think his wife does, I'm not sure.
But you thought it worthwhile paying them an afternoon visit, on the off chance, nevertheless.
I thought one of them might have been at home.
Mrs. Golding, perhaps?
One of them.
So there was no reply when you knocked or rang?
I rang the bell a number of times.
Let me be clear about the time here. It was about 4:30?
Yes. I looked at my watch at the time.
How far is it from Sutton to Carshalton, do you know?
It's about 2 miles, I think.
And how long would it normally take you to drive from your friend's place to your mother's in Carshalton?
5 minutes or so, I suppose. Perhaps 10.
You say you were at your mother's between 6:45 and 7.
Yes, that was the approximate time.
So, it took you over 2 hours to clean your sparking plugs. 2 hours.
I might have stopped somewhere for a cup of tea.
But you can't remember if you did?
No.
Although you are able to remember your movements on that day extremely well, but for this stopping for tea.
It has slipped my mind.
I put it to you that you were at your mother's at between 5:45 and 6 o'clock, and not between 6:45 and 7.
No. She will confirm I was with her about 7 o'clock.
Yes, I'm quite sure she will. No further questions, my lord. Mrs. Payne, were you expecting your son to call in on you that evening?
No.
Did he often call in unexpectedly?
No. You see, he lives quite a way away.
Yes, near Maidstone in Kent. So, you were surprised to see him, were you?
Yes. Yes, I was.
Did he tell you about his day's journey?
He mentioned going to London and to the Goldings.
And he told you of his car breaking down on his way from the Goldings to you?
I think he did. He must have.
You told the police in your statement that your son was with you between 7 o'clock and 7:40, did you not?
Yes, about those times.
You made a mental note of them that evening, I take it?
Yes, I suppose I must have.
I put it to you that you agreed those times with your son.
No, we haven't ever spoken of them.
I find that surprising, since so much depends on it.
Yes, if you look at it like that, it is.
I put it to you that your son arrived at between 5:45 and 6 o'clock and stayed no longer than 15 minutes.
No, that isn't so. He stayed longer than 15 minutes.
No further questions, my lord. Detective Constable, you drove from Mrs. Payne's place at Carshalton to Deep Dean Court at West Wickham one weekday evening at around 6 o'clock, I believe.
Yes, I did.
How long did it take you?
17 minutes, to be exact.
Mr. Buzzard left it to the jury to draw their own conclusions. He then called Dr. Margaret Pereira to the stand. This would be the first time her identification of a wide range of blood groups would be put to the test in a trial for murder.
Dr. Pereira, on this man's handkerchief found in the flat, you discovered infallible evidence of Claire Joseph's blood. How are you so sure?
Her blood group was an extremely rare one. Probably less than 100 people in this country share it. It's a variant of the AB group. We call it AB/MN-PGM21.
Was there blood of another group on this handkerchief?
Yes. It was of an uncommon O group type, the same as that of the defendant's.
I believe you found more of Claire Joseph's blood in the defendant's car.
Yes. A stain about 9 inches long of her blood in the driver's door pocket. There was a faint pattern of a serrated edge to the stain.
Were there any other traces of this rare blood group on an article of clothing belonging to the defendant?
Yes, on the inside band of the defendant's hat.
His hat. How would this come about, do you think?
Blood from such a wound to the throat as that which killed Mrs. Joseph's would have literally spurted out onto the murderer's head and into his face.
Did you examine the two used coffee cups from the flat?
Yes. One of them had saliva on it that matched the defendant's.
And you examined the coat and dress the dead woman was wearing at the time of her death?
I found fibres stuck to them which matched those of the trousers and the top coat Mr. Payne was wearing that day. I also found a thread from the scarf he was wearing under Mrs. Joseph's right thumbnail.
This forensic evidence alone is surely enough for you to find Roger John Payne guilty. But, ladies and gentlemen, you might say, what of his alibi, his visit to his mother? Of course he visited his mother. But he did so to provide himself with an alibi, knowing that his mother, like most of us, did not pay attention to the exact time that a visitor arrived or left. And can you believe that Mrs. Payne and her son did not discuss this timing before his arrest? Wasn't it his one chance of being let off the hook? Everything depended on it, but it was never mentioned. And let me remind you of the psychiatric evidence. It was that the defendant was sexually totally impotent, but subject to strong sexual urges nevertheless. The effect of this, we were told, could well be that as his lust couldn't be fulfilled in any normal sense, it would therefore become viciously aggressive to the object of his desire. Murderous, even.
Roger Payne was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment, a sentence he's still serving. Much has happened in the forensic world since he first went inside. Since 1968, the ABO test used by Dr. Pereira has been superseded, and the MN subgrouping of blood has been dropped. It's now considered unreliable with stains of blood. Forensic tests, like all physical evidence used in courts, are only as strong as their power to discriminate and so eliminate individuals or point a finger at them. Newer techniques meant more and more blood enzymes could be identified. But the real breakthrough came with DNA testing, which produces so-called genetic fingerprints.
In The Bloodstained Handkerchief, Sean Arnold played Detective Superintendent Cummings and Ian Swan played Roger Payne. Mary Payne was played by Teresa Stratfield. Other parts were played by David Lerner, Anne Windsor, Peter Gunn, and Joanna Myers. Murder Most Foul was written by Frederick Bradnam and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Matt Thompson.